Hello and welcome to everyone watching and listening online. Today we're going to spend a few minutes in my favorite story from the Gospel of John. And rather than paraphrasing or summarizing our way through this story like we've done in recent weeks when we've covered a longer narrative in John, I want you to hear every word of this amazing story about the man born blind in John chapter 9. It begins in verse 1. As Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." After saying this, Jesus spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that it was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then are your eyes opened?" they asked. He replied, "Well, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and I washed it, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore, the Pharisees also asked him how he received his sight. "Well, he put mud on my eyes," the man replied, "and I washed it, now I see." And some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others asked, "How can a sinner perform such signs?" So they were divided. Then they turned again to the blind man. "What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened." And the man replied, "He is a prophet." They still did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. "Is this your son?" they asked. "Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that now he can see?" "We know he is our son," the parents answered. "And we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders, who had already decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. This was why his parents said, "He's of age. Ask him." A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. "Give glory to God by telling the truth," they said. "We know this man is a sinner." He replied, "Whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." And then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And he answered, "I've told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses. But as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." And the man answered, "Now, that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. And we know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, "You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us?" And they threw him out. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out. And when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." And Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he's the one speaking to you." And the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." I've entitled today's message, "Will the Real Sinner Please Stand Up?" Because one of the questions driving this story forward is, who sinned? In the opening scene, that's the question Jesus' disciples ask him when they come upon this man born blind. Conventional wisdom held that such afflictions were punishment for sin. Now the only question was it his parents who sinned, causing him to be born blind? Or did this man somehow sin in his mother's womb and bring this punishment upon himself? Who sinned? Why this man was born blind is not nearly as interesting or as important to Jesus as is what he intends to do next. Jesus sees his blindness as an opportunity to perform yet another sign. And this sign will point to him being the light of the world who shines into the darkness. And so Jesus spits on the ground and makes some mud and, well, you've already heard the man tell his story a couple of times. And after this opening scene, Jesus disappears and he doesn't return until the very end. In between, this man is harassed by the Pharisees who take it upon themselves to investigate his healing. When some of the Pharisees hear that Jesus has once again healed someone on the Sabbath, just as he did back in chapter 5, only this time he spit on the ground and made mud, which according to some rabbis was a form of work which was prohibited on the Sabbath, it's all the evidence they need, yet another sign that no, this man is a lawbreaker who cannot come from God. And yet there are others among them who have to ask the question, well, how can a sinner perform such miraculous signs? And they find themselves in a bind. Because a sinner, like Jesus, should not be able to perform miracles. And a true miracle worker from God would not break the law. So what are they supposed to do with Jesus? And what are they supposed to do with this man who keeps telling this story about Jesus opening his eyes? Their solution is to try to prove that the man had never been blind to begin with. Just undermine the credibility of the whole thing. And when they bring the man's parents in, much to the Pharisees' chagrin, try saying that three times fast, they verify that, yes, indeed, he's our son, and he was born blind. But we don't know how his eyes came to be open, and they won't say anything about Jesus because the Pharisees had already threatened to throw anyone who dared say that Jesus was the Messiah out of the synagogue, which was a harsh punishment, and we'll talk more about it next week. And so the Pharisees interview the man a second time. And they demand he tell the truth because they know beyond a shadow of a doubt, they are convinced Jesus is a sinner who willingly and intentionally breaks the law of God. And yet this man, who could not be more unlike the invalid Jesus healed back in chapter 5, keeps telling a story and using their logic against them, essentially asking, if Jesus is a sinner, how is it that I can see? And when he finally insists that his sight is proof that Jesus has to come from God, has to be from God, the Pharisees remind him that he's been steeped in sin since birth. It's a callback to the original question, why was this man born blind? Well, the Pharisees know he's a sinner. And so they throw him out, which presumably means they kick him out of the synagogue. And when Jesus hears that they've done this to the man, Jesus finds him. And for the first time, the man sees Jesus with his eyes. Even though he's deep into the process of already recognizing who Jesus is and believing in him. So finally, the man sees Jesus, both literally and figuratively. And he worships him as the Lord. And that's when Jesus flips the script. He says, the one who is blind can now see, but those who think they can see are actually blind. And this is aimed at the Pharisees, some of whom are standing there, and they know he's talking about them, and they ask, do you really think we're blind when we can clearly see? Once again, someone misunderstands what Jesus says figuratively and takes him literally. We're not blind, we can see. And that's when Jesus finally declares who the real sinner in this story is. It's not him. He's doing the work of his Father in heaven. It's not the man who was born blind, whose eyes are now wide open. The real sinners in this story are the Pharisees. They are stuck in sin. Their sin remains or abides. There's that word again. They are stuck in sin. Because while they claim they can see clearly, they are blind to the presence and activity of God in their midst. And this is part of a long, ongoing conflict that Jesus has with the religious leaders in Jerusalem. It begins early on in the gospel. Back in chapter 2, when Jesus cleansed the temple, the religious leaders knew he was going to be a problem. And then in chapter 5, when he healed the invalid on the Sabbath and told him he could carry his mat on the Sabbath, they judged that Jesus was a serious threat to their power, to their traditions, to their way of life, and they began looking for ways to eliminate him. And then in one of their long exchanges in chapter 7, Jesus diagnoses their problem. He tells them in chapter 7, verse 24, speaking to the religious leaders, he says, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. The problem is they are so convinced that Jesus has to be a sinner because he heals on the Sabbath that they cannot see the deeper meaning, the deeper truth. The signs, the healings, the miracles are pointing to. They're missing it. They're blind to it. Sometimes our initial assessment or judgment about a person or an event or a situation is incomplete and inaccurate. And a second or a third deeper look is required. Sometimes we have to look again. We have to look deeper. Which brings me to this question. Why is this man running away in the snow? Or is that really what's going on in this picture? Is this really a picture of a man running away in the snow? Or is it a dog running toward the camera? Sometimes a deeper look is required. And the religious leaders decided early on that Jesus could not be from God. And everything that follows is confirmation bias. Their investigation is not to determine if maybe Jesus is the Messiah, maybe they need to take a second look. No, they've already decided he isn't. They're already threatening to punish people who would suggest that he is. The purpose of their investigation is to gather evidence of their judgment against Jesus while ignoring or dismissing any evidence to the contrary. That's why their first strategy is to prove that the man was never blind in the first place. And it gets worse the farther we go into the gospel. Later on, when Jesus raises Lazarus, spoiler alert, raises Lazarus from the dead, and more people are taking Jesus seriously in Jerusalem, the religious leaders decide that they not only need to kill Jesus, but they also need to kill Lazarus as well, because he's one piece of evidence they cannot explain away. Reminds me of the story of Hiro Onoda. He was a Japanese soldier who was dropped off in 1944 on an island in the Philippines. His mission was to conduct guerrilla warfare in the jungles on that island and disrupt the Allied forces. So he and a small band of fellow soldiers disappeared into the jungle and set about their mission. He did not come out of that jungle until 30 years later in 1974, when his former commanding officer instructed him to surrender to the Philippine authorities. The war had ended just a few months after he disappeared into the jungle. And the Japanese government made repeated attempts to communicate with him and tell him to come out and come home. But he refused to listen. He was convinced the Japanese army would never surrender. And he even interpreted recorded messages played over loudspeakers from his family, including his father, as coded instructions to stay in the jungle and keep fighting. He ignored, he misunderstood, he even twisted evidence to fit his conviction. Later on, he wrote in his autobiography that he and the two other soldiers who were with him in the jungle, both of them died in the jungle. He said they developed so many fixed ideas that they were unable to understand anything that did not conform with them. If there was anything that did not fit in with their convictions and their beliefs, he said, we interpreted it to mean whatever we wanted it to mean. Imagine living in a world where no amount of evidence can convince someone that they're wrong about another person or an event or a situation. They will believe what they will believe. They will maintain their convictions in spite of a preponderance of evidence to the contrary. Wait, are we still talking about the religious leaders in ancient Jerusalem? Of course we are. This sermon is about them. It's not about us. As one writer puts it, the religious leaders in Jerusalem are not only wrong about Jesus, but they have constructed a system in which it's impossible for them to see just how wrong they are. It's one thing to be genuinely mistaken about someone, some event, some situation, and still be open to further evidence, information, and insight. It's another thing completely To live in a closed world, walled off from new experiences, new evidence, new insight that would challenge our beliefs or values or view of the world. Okay. I guess this message is about us after all. Because we're all guilty of confirmation bias. I do it, you do it. It's unavoidable and inescapable. We make a decision, we settle on a conviction, and then we go looking for evidence to support what we've decided, what we believe. And it's easy to dismiss or ignore anything that contradicts our conviction. Confirmation bias shapes what news channel we watch. It shapes who we follow on social media. It shapes what parts of the Bible we like to read and how we read our favorite parts of the Bible. It shapes the verses we quote over and over and over again, and it shapes the verses we ignore and never talk about. It shapes the teachings of Jesus we take seriously and the ones we set aside because they are now irrelevant. Confirmation bias can help explain why some people of faith automatically reject any new scientific discovery that challenges their worldview. It also can help explain why some scientists refuse to consider a faith-based or divine probability or cause for anything they can't observe or measure or replicate in a lab. There's a difference between admitting that we're not seeing the whole picture, that we might be wrong, that confirmation bias is something we're vulnerable to. There's a difference between that and pretending it's not a problem at all. There's a big difference between holding on to our beliefs and values and convictions so firmly that it gives purpose and meaning and direction to our lives while still being open to new information, new insight, new evidence, and being unable to admit that or even consider the possibility that some of our beliefs and values and convictions are in need of revision or maybe even repentance. The problem, Jesus says, no, the sin, Jesus says, is not in being blind. It's in thinking we see everything there is to see, which then blinds us to all the truth about God, the world, and one another we're missing. May Jesus, the light of the world, open our eyes to the fullness of God's truth shining throughout creation. Let's sing.